Coming to you from the brig of the Queen Anne's Revenge, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Oh, please, somebody pay us.
Everybody, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa. We are also coming this week literally from the inside of my closet, which is hilarious, because I've moved to a new apartment that happens to be on the corner of two very busy streets and right next door to the fire station. I live in a loud place now.
You live where you are going to grad school now, yes?
Yes, I am a student once again. I have mixed feelings about this matter. but I've this past month started a PhD in philosophy, which is disgusting. I'm already regretting it, but like we're here for the long run now. I am, miracle of all miracles, getting paid to go to school.
Hey!
So I'm living the dream.
That's really a beautiful thing.
It is.
You're fulfilling
shit, bruh.
You're fulfilling what prophecy our intro can provide?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Exactly.
All right, well, our show today involves nothing that I did, which I'm pretty excited about. We have the return of mythology time with Rissa, doing Norse mythology this time. The real question is, Cleo, where do you want to put the cursed science facts?
Well, it depends. Like, how well do we want our listeners to sleep after hearing these facts? Because I'm not sleeping tonight.
I want, like, an ontology of what makes it cursed. But at the same time, I feel like the answer is just going to be my reaction to these.
Basically.
I'm actually really interested if I'm, surprised by any of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I don't know. Some point in this episode, we're going to have some cursed science facts, whose name was inspired by Rissa's reaction to some of my last science facts.
I'm disturbed. You said sometime in this episode, and that makes it feel like I'm going to be halfway through what I'm doing, and you're just going to be like, here come the facts! I'm worried now.
I will give you ample warning. They're not jack-in-the-box facts that just pop up in the middle of the episode like a jump scare.
Why don't you give us some of them now and then some of them after touch on Norse mythology?
I don't think I want to be bracketed by that.
I do.
Okay.
So, do you want me to just go ahead and say it now? So, welcome, friends and neighbors, to the start of a new segment that I am calling Cursed Science Facts.
Right.
Yes, I, Cleo,
I already dread this.
Goddess of history, am going to start teaching you science, so prepare to cringe in as many ways as possible.
I feel like this is going to get confusing, though, we have someone called Science, and now we have a different science purveyor.
I gave a history of radio and the Prohibition. I mean, we're not exactly staying in our lane on this show.
No.
I love that my lane is just me.
There are no lanes. This show is a giant game of Frogger. And there are
true.
No lanes.
I think we need new business cards made with that line.
Can I just say that was a particularly apt metaphor?
It was very good.
It's very good.
Also, no one under 30 who listens to this show is going to understand it.
Everybody knows what Frogger
is. It's called culture.
Google it, children.
Okay. Give me your cursed science facts. I'm ready to be cursed.
Okay, so the last time I talked about science, I mentioned the fact that there exists in this world snail teeth.
Oh no, I was not ready to be cursed. I take it back. I did not want to be reminded of that. I had successfully forgotten that. Oh no.
Do you want to actually, wait in fear during your whole colloquium?
No, just go ahead. Just rip the band-aid.
Okay, so, yes, you heard it first here. Snails have teeth. Some marine snails have teeth made of substance that is harder than diamonds.
But they shouldn't, though.
They shouldn't. And,
it's a moral, morally reprehensible thing.
It really is. And not only do they have the moral gall to have teeth, there are so many other horrible things about snails.
Oh, good!
So basically, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you all of the horrible things I learned about snails. Snails...
There are many benefits to being a marine biologist.
I don't know if I would call this a benefit. Like, literally, I was texting you guys before we started recording, because I was doing some last-minute research, and I was like, where's Jeff Bezos? Can I go to Mars?
Like, he can go to Mars. Come on.
So, snails are gastropods. There are over 65,000 species of gastropods on this planet. And snails and slugs.
Snugs?
Snugs. Sorry.
Snails and slugs, neither of which are snuggly, make up the largest groups of gastropods. Snails have shells, and slugs don't.
I really thought you were going to say snails have teeth and slugs don't.
Slugs have teeth. I am sorry to inform you.
Oh, no!
So, a lot of times we think of snails and slugs as herbivores. They eat plants. They can be garden pests. Unfortunately, I hate to tell you that not all of them are herbivores. Some of them are omnivores. Some of them are carnivorous and hunt other snails.
It's like a slow motion nature documentary.
It is. I will link to one. You can watch it. It's horrifying.
Fantastic.
And they don't. So snails have shells that are meant to protect them from predators, but those shells don't do you much good if you're being chased by a predatory snail that can secrete acid and burn through your shell.
Oh god. Oh no.
Yeah, the
what
large
kind of acid.
It's a calcium-based acid, at least in one species.
Ooh, a super acid.
Oh no, thank you.
No, I did not need to know that. That's even worse information. Thank you.
You've opened up a Pandora's box over here.
This is terrible. Okay, so the largest land snail has a shell that's about 8 inches across. The largest freshwater snail has a shell that's about 4 inches across. The largest marine snail has a shell that can be over 2 feet wide.
Don't.
Yes!
Yes.
No.
Uh-huh. One particularly fun fact, talk about slow motion hunting. So in Australia, they have the Great Barrier Reef, this giant coral reef, and it is very endangered by pollution and all sorts of things. One of the things that is contributing to the degradation of the Great Barrier Reef is the crown of thorns starfish.
What?
The crown of thorns starfish is horrifying in its own right. Apart from its connection to snails, it's covered in venomous spines and produces more offspring than any other creature on Earth. Over 50 million eggs each breeding season, and the young feed almost exclusively on coral.
Oh no!
Yeah, so they're eating.
What eats it?
Well, lots of things can't because, again, it's covered in venomous spines, but there is one creature that has developed a tolerance to crown of thorns starfish venom, and that is the giant triton snail.
Yes.
Oh.
At over 1.5 feet long, it chases down the crown of thorns starfish, and because it is immune to the venom, doesn't die. Also, the saliva of the giant triton snail has paralyzing chemicals in it.
Okay.
So, once it catches the starfish and doesn't die because it's developed an immunity to iocane powder, it spits on the starfish and paralyzes it and then eats it.
Wow! I love it!
Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to make a joke about, like, which one could possibly be slower, a snail or a starfish, but I guess the answer is somehow the starfish.
Somehow the starfish. I mean, the starfish is paralyzed at this point. But we'll have to link. I found a video of the entire chase, and it's quite riveting. We'll have to link to it.
Yeah, but those will all be in the show notes.
I'm not gonna watch it.
I will.
Speaking of snails and chemicals, did you know that some snails and slugs will shoot hormone-laden darts out of their bodies into potential mates?
That seems like a crime.
Seems like a very aggressive dating strategy. Are you telling me that snails, like,
date rape people, or what's happening?
No, it's just that if those two snails then happen to mate, the extra dose of hormones can potentially help ensure that the eggs are fertilized.
Oh!
Still seems like a crime.
Yeah, it's more like
I want snail consent.
Well, it doesn't always work. It doesn't have anything to do with, like, convincing the other snail to mate with you. It's, like, it's weird.
So it's just a really good perfume.
That's what they all say.
But, fun fact, some naturalists believe that because one species of snail that does this was present in ancient Greek, it may have served as part of the inspiration for the myth of Cupid.
Huh. Okay, that's awesome.
Snails are an aphrodisiac, I believe.
Or they're supposed to be.
They're supposed to be.
Nothing's an aphrodisiac, really.
That's what you think.
Listen, taste is highly subjective. And also, all of the food that they make these claims about have never shown any aphrodisiacal properties. Like, just saying.
That's what they want you to think.
Mm-hmm. Listen, if it works for you, good, but it's not going to work for everybody else.
But, so snails may have inspired the myth of Cupid, so if you're one of those people who feel that Valentine's Day has become way too commercialized, skip the roses and buy your beloved a snail.
I would buy that. Yeah.
Sound advice.
Make sure that the snail has been... Make sure that the snail has been cleared of parasites, because snails can carry parasites.
Right. You should never accept snails as a gift.
Yeah. But, you know... Such as love.
Have either of you ever eaten snails?
No!
No, I haven't. I had a pet snail I was a kid. I had a pet snail when I was a kid.
I had a pet mouse.
I had a dog.
Okay.
I mean, listen, the cat and the dog, those were my parents' pets. But Gary the golden snail was mine, and he lived on my desk. Moved and he died.
You had a Pokemon, that's what you had.
Yes, I did.
Wonderful. Love it. Love to see it. Live your best life.
I will.
So yeah, those are some facts about the world that we inhabit. These are the kinds of creatures that live in it. You share an unknown amount of space with them. They are everywhere.
That was the most ominous way you could possibly say that.
They are everywhere. On land, on sea. Some of them have lungs, some of them have gills, some of them have both.
Oh, no.
So that's some fun facts about snails.
Think that you were going to say some of them have bones, and I was like, they don't have bones, but they do have teeth.
One of you scientists needs to do an episode on carcinogens.
I'm thinking about it. I'm not a biology person generally, and those kinds of, you know, greater evolutionary trends, it's kind of like the trend that domesticated animals get cuter. It's like, it's observable, but it's not necessarily, we don't necessarily know what it means.
Yeah. So, now that I have finished, horrifying everyone, Rissa, would you like to tell us, some fun stories about mythology?
Yeah, so, like, a lot of Norse mythology stories aren't fun, but I feel like it's, like, you set such a low bar. I'm feeling pretty good.
It only gets better from here.
Okay.
It only gets more Viking from here.
Also, Science, I need you to promise me that you're going to forget everything I told you so that when we play our D&D game later, you won't have any spoilers. Anyway.
I refuse.
Thank you. Okay.
Spoiler alert.
Okay, so...
For Loki, your brothers.
Sorry. I'm on a different table than normal, and I keep accidentally hitting it, and I'm sure it's making the audio bad, so I'm gonna
That's okay.
Sorry about that. Audio to Nat, who's editing this. I had to move the table further away from myself so I wouldn't do what I was talking. Okay.
By the way, Rissa, mm-hmm. I will absolutely not forget anything that you say today. That might be useful to me in the game
okay,
that we play.
But I do
promise several times to say North mythology instead of Norse mythology because that's a vocal tic
well,
that I have.
I mean, Norse means north. The Norsemen are the Northmen.
It doesn't.
They're the men from the north.
Listen, your etymological justifications are validating, but I still sound like I have a lisp.
Okay. That's fair. Yeah, Normans, Norsemen, Northmen. Anyway.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so last time I spoke on this podcast, it was about Greek mythology, and I'm far from done with that. So you know, if you're just like really waiting on that, don't worry, I'll get back to it. There's a huge wealth of stories to tell. I haven't even gotten to most of the human heroes. We talked about Heracles, but not about Jason, Achilles, Theseus, Perseus, Oedipus, Orpheus, Atalanta, Odysseus. Like, I have a list. Okay, I have a list.
A lot of yeses.
And we'll get to those. But today I want to take a break and talk about a few other gods that have gotten a lot more of attention lately. Which is Norse mythology. I feel like Norse mythology has been a thing for a while, but has somehow gotten a lot more attention recently. Which is great. I love it. Love to see it. Before we begin, though, I need something from both of you.
Okay.
Okay, can you do... I need... This is for our listeners, too. I need you to do something for me before we start.
Okay.
Right now, just for now, please forget everything you know about Marvel Comics.
That won't be difficult.
Okay. Yeah, that won't be hard.
All right. Everything Marvel has ever told you about Norse mythology is a lie, and I need you to forget it. For the record, I'm not mad at Marvel Comics. Like, they do some good stuff. Actually, I am mad at Marvel Comics, but that's a different story. I'm not mad at Marvel Comics for this. I am mad at Disney for their Hercules film. But a lot of Marvel's ideas are very cool. Honestly, I really like them. I like Thor a lot. But they're going to get in the way today. So if you like Marvel Comics, keep that to yourself, and we'll be fine.
How much do I need to forget about what I know about the background of Lord of the Rings?
Just forget, just know that, especially in The Hobbit, almost every single name that J.R.R. Tolkien used, he did not make up. Aside from the Elvish ones, which he did make up because he made up the language, everybody else has a name that is just straight up listed from the Eddas, including Gandalf and a lot of other people.
Nice.
Cool.
We're not actually going to talk about that too much today, though.
I just actually want to thank you for freeing my mind of the Marvel movies.
I've
really
banished it forever.
That. Thank you.
Yeah, I needed
that. I owe
that.
You my life.
We need that cleanse. Okay. I'm going to try to stop touching my desk because it's making the desk move. Okay. That said, what I am telling today is, as always, just one version of these myths. If you want more, I highly recommend a book simply called Norse Mythology by Neil Gaiman.
Huh.
The same Neil Gaiman who did, you know, Stardust and Good Omens and all that stuff. I own this book in three different versions. I own the book, the audiobook, and the radio play that I had to get physically shipped in from the UK.
Oh my gosh.
I love this book. All three versions are fantastic. The audiobook is read by Neil, and he does great. Anyway, if you'd rather go for your primary sources, there's always the poetic and prose Eddas. You can find translations pretty well. These are from around the 13th century from Iceland. And there's various other texts. I mean, frankly, read Wikipedia. Like, you'll actually learn a lot if you do. But anyway, that's how most of these stories were preserved, is from these texts from Iceland. Pretty late. The 13th century is not the height of Norse culture. It's in the latter half of it. Like the Homeric tales, Norse mythology was a primarily oral tradition, which was finally written down after Christianity was actually overtaking Norse culture in Europe, largely in order to preserve them. Because of this, a lot of these stories were never preserved. Like, we'll have references to, like, oh, you all know that one time that Heimdall fought Loki and they were both walruses. And you're like, excuse me? But we don't have that story. We know that they were fighting over the Necklace of the Brisings. It's a long story. We don't really know what happened. We don't have it because it, like, wasn't important enough. Or it just got lost. or some of them, like Beowulf, were written under heavy Christian influences. So it's you know, it's worth noting that, like, there are different versions of this, and these are somewhat Christianized ones. Maybe the ones that Christianity felt tolerable enough, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's also worth noting that there are a lot of people who actively modern-day worship these gods. So if you really want to know, there are lots better people you could ask. I'm going to be treating them like I did the Greeks, stories that were extremely important to the culture at the time, but have evolved to modern day. I'm also going to be treating them more as stories than as religion. I don't know that much about the actual religion, so that's not what we're going for here.
Sorry, pagans.
But they are really important to the language and culture that they preserve, and they were written down to preserve. This is actually the reason that Christians and others wrote down and preserved these stories, is because they had such a profound impact on the languages. This is primarily in two things. One is place names. A lot of what we know about ancient Norse-type languages is actually preserved in place names. And the second is what's called a kenning. A kenning is a type of nickname that's usually longer than the real thing. It's a compound word that expresses some quality of something. So, for instance, a kenning for the ocean. If I was writing poetry and I wanted to talk about the ocean, I wouldn't say ocean. I would say something like, we crossed the whale road.
At this point, I do want to point out whales that a podcast that I really enjoy had a story arc that took place on a pirate ship, and it was called I've Been Working on the Whale Road, and it was the best
yes.
thing ever.
Yes. So the whale road is the ocean. It's like a road, but for the whales. A ship could be a sea steed. It's like your horse, but on the ocean. A lot of these are ocean-related or war-related. But the word for which there are the most kennings, can anyone guess what the word for which there are the most preserved kennings?
I mean, my gut says bear, but that just might be Tumblr's nope. influence.
You got anything else?
Fire.
Gold!
Really?
Gold.
Yeah. Freya's tears, Sif's hair, the otter's ransom are all different kennings for gold. The Norse actually, well, I say the Norse as if it's one language, but in the preserved text, there are a lot of different words for different types of gold. So Freya's tears is specifically like a rose gold, like a red gold, whereas Sif's hair would be much more like a wheat gold, like a,
nice.
Yeah, anyway. Gold. Where you get this whole, like, dwarves are obsessed with gold nonsense is Norse mythology.
Oh, so yeah.
The One
Tolkien
Ring,
just
also Norse mythology.
Culture.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He would
oh, yeah.
Never.
Okay.
Yeah, no. The One Ring, Norse mythology. Like, everything in here, Norse mythology.
Okay.
Nazgul,
all right.
Like, it, yeah. Tolkien was not nearly as original. Yeah. Okay, anyway, let's get on to some stories. You good? Yeah?
Yes.
Sorry, I was just asking for some confirmation there.
Very good.
So, just with Greek myth, we're going to start at the beginning.
Right.
Okay. A good place to start, and we're just going to see how many stories we can go through. Today I'm going to focus on the creation myth and the kind of introduction of the players, so that next time we could do some just straight-up storytelling. So, you have probably heard that Norse cosmology is made up of the nine realms. We'll get to these realms, but in the beginning, there were two. There was Muspelheim, the primordial realm of fire, and there was Niflheim, the primordial realm of ice, among other things. And between these two realms stretched a great nothing, a void known as the Gnungagap.
Could you
really
spell that for
say.
Me real quick?
Gnungagap?
Yes.
Yeah. Hold, please. I'm Googling my own spelling, just in case. Yeah, okay. Gnungagap is Ginnungagap. Gnungagap.
That is a wonderful
that
word.
That rules.
I love that word.
It's a fun word.
All right,
and it is the void which stretches between all realities. Gnungagap.
Yes.
Anyway, across the Gnungagap, ice flowed and rime froze out of Niflheim, where everything was so cold that this kind of cold vapor rose up even into the void. And sparks flew from the great fires of Muspel until they met the ice. and in the middle of nowhere, there was a somewhere in the void, a point at which these two met, and it is said that the air there was as mild as a windless sky. This is where the giant glaciers of Niflheim began to melt as they met the fire. And as they melted, water became existent. And as the first water was revealed, something was revealed in the ice, or quite possibly came to be from the water. And the first thing was the giant form of a man. I say a man. He was both male and female, but is generally assigned male pronouns, so we're just going to keep calling him he.
Okay.
His name was Ymir, the first and greatest of the giants. And we'll get back to Ymir. But meanwhile, the second thing, which was revealed from the ice as it melted, was a cow.
Okay.
her name was Aldumblr. We do love Aldumblr. It is said that it is her milk which nourished Ymir and brought him to full adulthood. Ymir herself was nourished by licking the salty rime of ice. And as she licked, she revealed a third thing, another man called Búri, the first of the gods. So Ymir, Búri, and Aldumblr were not alone for very long, because Ymir had the power of creation, not intentionally. He was asleep, and while he was asleep, things arose from him. From between his legs and even under his arms came out descendants, the first of the giants called the Jotun. And one of these, named Besla, married the man whom Aldumblr had revealed, Búri. So this is kind of the first couple to have children in the normal fashion, unlike whatever Ymir's got going on. remember that Ymir is both male and female, so he has this kind of generative power within themself. I don't know. Like I said, Ymir tends to have male pronouns. Anyway. Besla and Búri, the first kind of daughter of Ymir and this other man, bore three sons, and their names are Vili, Ve, and Odin.
I recognize one of those names.
Yes. So, there are now several living things, but we are still in the nowhere. There is ice and fire and water and void. And it was Odin who knew that this would not do for a world. The world could not be a nowhere forever. They needed to make a somewhere. But where would they get the supplies? They couldn't conjure things out of air. Odin knew what they needed to do. There was no choice to be made. It had to be done. This is something Odin is known for. He and his brothers came up with a plan, and the three of them together killed the great giant Ymir. With his death, though, came all of the worlds. It is with the body of Ymir that they made the worlds. The first thing that happened when they killed Ymir was a great and terrible flood. Ymir was so large that as the blood of Ymir, dark and gray and salty, rushed out of his wounds, they became the mightiest of oceans. And in this terrible flood, almost all of the young life in the world was wiped out. Only Odin, his brothers Vili and Ve, and two of the giants, Bergelmir and his wife, who made the first boat, survived. This may be why the giants hate the gods so much.
You think?
I would too. With the blood of Ymir becoming the seas and oceans, Odin and his brothers took the other parts of him and made the world. With his flesh, they made the land. With his teeth and bones, they made rocks and mountains. With his hair, they made plants and trees. And with his brains, they made the clouds. And even the great dome of heaven, the sky itself, was made from Ymir. For if you go outside and look up, what you're seeing is, in fact, the inside of Ymir's skull. Lastly, from Ymir's eyebrows or eyelashes, I'm not sure which, the gods created a giant wall or gate, splitting this world in two, the inner and outer lands, and the greatest of oceans flowed between them. The outer worlds became the haunt of the giants, called Jotunheim, while the inner realm is where Odin and his brothers stayed for a time. One day, Bodin, Vili, and Ve, who again were staying in this protected inner realm and creating order and creating the world, were walking along the beach they had made, and on it they found a pair of beautiful logs, driftwood washed up by the new ocean, made of ash and elm wood. Odin stood the logs up, and the three gods carved them into shapes. They carved one male and one female, and gave each of them gifts. Odin gave them life, Vili gave them movement, and Ve gave them names, as long as clothing to keep them safe. And their names were Ask and Elmbler, Ash and Elm. And they are the mother and father of all mankind, which was given by the gods Midgard, the middle realm, the inside of the world that had been made. After this, it's a little unclear how the rest of the worlds come into existence. Nobody cares about them. But in addition to the two primordial realms, Muspel and Niflheim, which have existed forever, and the realms of the humans, Midgard, and giants, Jotunheim, there are also two more realms, two realms of the gods, Asgard and Vanaheim, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and two realms for the elves, Alfheim and Nidavellir, which is also called Svartalfheim. And one more realm to make the nine, which later came to be known by the name of its queen, Hel. But we will have to wait for
a different time to talk about her. Wait, the queen is named
Hel? The queen is named Hel. Her name is Hel. Not Hela. Again, please forget everything Marvel ever told you about. I personally do love Hel a lot. She's great. Anyway, yeah, again, please forget everything they told you. Hel and Hela are very different people. Anyway, unfortunately, one of the very first stories we have about the gods, really the earliest we have after this, is that once they're all established, they have a war.
Oh, good.
Ooh, it kind of reminds me of the Greek wars between the gods and the Titans and the gods and the giants. It kind of helps establish who the heroes are, but there's not a lot of stories about, like, the actual waging of the war. And not a lot of stories are set in this time. All we really know is that the gods had been split into two groups. They're what's called the Aesir, the sky gods of Asgard, and Asgard literally just means home of the Aesir, and the Vanir, the earth gods of Vanaheim, and again, Vanaheim literally just means the home of the Vanir, so very descriptive with names. Why were the Aesir and Vanir fighting? We don't know. How did it happen? Don't know. All we know is that Odin, the leader of the Aesir, both started this fight and ended it, and that at the end of the world war, the gods worked together to form a peace. The Aesir won. That's why Odin is still, like, the lord of the gods. What happened to Vili and Ve, by the way? Don't know. There's a lot of don't knows around here. Anyway, several of the Vanir came to live into Asgard after the war, and a few of the Aesir moved to Vanaheim, and this became a model for something very common in Norse history, and really world history, which sounds really terrible to modern ears, but was extremely common at the time, which is the exchange of prisoners to create peace. So the thought behind this is twofold. One, it's you know, it's an intentional mixing of culture and worked really well if these captives were children, that you're, like, born to one family but brought up by another one. And to top this all off, there is always the threat that if you start another war after our peace is decreed, the first person to die in that war will be our captives.
The Greeks did that with Cleopatra's family.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Like I said, this isn't a Norse thing. This is, very much a universal thing, but it's part of Norse myth in a way that it's not part of most other mythologies, in that this very early starting myth is about the gods exchanging hostages between themselves.
I have a question.
Yes.
In Greek mythology, you know, whether or not you should model yourself after the gods is kind of like, not really. You model yourself after heroes. Where in other religions, like, modeling yourself after, like, in Judaism and Christianity, like, modeling yourself after God is kind of, like, just a thing you do. Do you think Norse mythos builds, like, a paradigm of you should or you shouldn't model yourself after the God?
Okay. This is an excellent question. then one that I'm not entirely equipped to have the answers to. So Norse myth does have both humans and gods. They almost never, ever interact with each other, except for a few small stories. Huh. And which of them is to be the model? There are lots of ways in which you would model yourselves after the gods, but mostly you would claim individual things. I have the authority of Odin. I have the strength of Thor. I have the virility of the gods, that kind of thing. Odin is very human in a similar way to the gods are, but like there's a lot of ways that you can read Norse myth and read it as like, okay, sorry about that. I'm going to repeat some of this. It may be that there was an honest to God human tribe represented by the Aesir, and an honest to God human tribe represented by the Vanir, who actually did have a war, and one of them actually won and kind of proclaimed himself the King of Kings and ended up as this kind of godlike figure. I mentioned that a lot of these were written down after the influence of Christianity. Some of them actually record it like this. Like, they try to say, hey, I'm recording a history of these people who came to be worshipped as gods, but they're really people, and we all know that because the real god is God. Get some of that. So, as far as the culture of who you should emulate goes, I don't know. That's an excellent question. We don't have, like, there isn't the Plato of Norse world. Huh. To tell us a lot about that. You would definitely want a lot of aspects of the gods, whether you would, and you know, just like lots of other things. The gods don't tend to do stuff that is illegal for humans, unlike Zeus, except Odin. We'll talk about this a little bit, but Odin and Loki both break gender norms in ways that were not very accepted in what we see of culture, in that both of them practice what's called seidir, which is a type of magic that in culture would have been reserved for women. And I can talk about a little bit about that, though. Really, the only other thing I was going to do is give us a little overview of all of the gods so we know who they are and who they're not, because they're not Marvel characters.
Yeah, let's meet our players. Yes.
Yeah, so let's meet the players, and then next time I can tell some stories. So the first that we've already met is Odin. You probably know Odin. He is called the All-Father, the One-Eyed God, and I'll tell you the story of how he lost his eye eventually. Frankly, I don't really know why he's called the All-Father, as we've all seen that he has a father, and anyway. Odin is the King of Heaven. He is the Lord of the Aesir. He is the God of wisdom, knowledge, magic, war, executions, judgment, and prophecy. He is called the Hanged God. He is called many, many, many things. Odin, the really only thing you need to know about Odin is that Odin is absolutely paranoid.
Okay.
Obsessed with Ragnarok. You've probably heard the word Ragnarok. Marvel does use it. Ragnarok is the prophecy of the ending of the world in which all of the gods will die and the world will die. And Odin knows this, and just like from the start, everything is doomed, and Odin does almost everything that he does in order to gain wisdom and knowledge to stop Ragnarok, subvert Ragnarok, just know about Ragnarok, all of these things. And he gets really paranoid about it. And a big theme in Norse mythology is like, everything that Odin does to stop Ragnarok is the thing that makes it happen.
Oh, of course.
Odin is doomed. All of the gods are doomed, but Odin is more doomed than everyone else, mostly because Odin is the only one who can't seem to accept it.
Aha.
Odin is a really interesting character. He is a good guy and a bad guy. I am not a fan, but a lot of people are. Odin has a lot of symbols. Most of these have stories. Like I said, Odin has one eye. He also has a mighty spear called Gungnir, which you'll hear the story of. He has several animals associated with him, especially a pair of ravens called Hugin and Munin. They are thought and memory. They go about all the earth and come back and whisper in Odin's ear of what they see so that he knows everything. He has hounds as well as an eight-legged horse called Sleipnir. whose story I will also tell later.
I feel like I know this one.
You do. Let's see. Next is Odin's wife, the Queen of Heaven. Her name is Frigg. She's actually where we get the word Friday. Frigg's Day.
It's Frigg her day.
Is very much like Hera. She's the goddess of motherhood and marriage, also clairvoyance. Unlike Hera, though, she seems to have no jealousy whatsoever when her husband has children by others. Like, that's just not part of their story. In fact, it may be that most of his other sons were born before they were married. Because there is, like, it's possible for stories to happen before this, because the gods kind of don't get fully embodied until later. So she doesn't have the aspect of Hera does, like, from Heracles. She's never a villain. Frigg is great. We love her. Let's see. But
she's
there's like, not a lot of stories about Frigg, surprisingly.
She's like who Hera wants to be.
Pretty much. Let's see. So the foremost of the sons of Odin is not born to Frigg. This is Thor. Thor's mother is actually an earth goddess. Or more like Earth itself, in a way. She's kind of a Gaia figure, but subtracted from the mother of all. She's an earth spirit.
Huh.
We don't know much about her, frankly. Like, she's not that important. Anyway, Thor, as you probably all know, is the god of...
Thunder!
My sister will be clapping her hands at this time because she's obsessed with Imagine Dragons.
Good for her. Good for her, really. Okay, god of thunder. He is the god of strength, protection, fertility. You'll see that almost all of the Norse gods are gods of fertility. That's just how they roll. Anyway, he's got a big-ass hammer called Mjolnir, which is also a story I will tell. Thor is married to the goddess Sif. Sif doesn't really have a ton of character beyond being Thor's wife. But
that's
we do like her.
Shame.
I know. Okay, here's the thing. There is evidence that there are a lot of goddesses. We don't know many of their stories.
Do you think that that's more a function of the people who were writing them down? And
could be.
Or is it just that's
yes
kind of the
no.
way that Norse society was structured?
I think a little bit of both. I think it's definitely which stories got written down. But also, while we have a lot of archaeological evidence of the worship of Odin and Thor and Freyr, and Freya even, a lot of these minor gods, we don't have a lot of, like, totems of them or anything like that. And there's a couple... Idun is a character I didn't write up notes about, but she's a goddess. I can tell Idun's story if we want to do that. She's a goddess. She's like a... kind of a goddess of medicine. It's a long story. Anyway. Let's see. The next up, as far as, like, top gods go, is the first son of Odin and Frigg. So the first kind of... I don't want to call Thor an illegitimate son, as I believe he was born before the marriage. I don't know. I'm making that up. Whatever. It doesn't matter. The first son of Frigg... by Odin, is Baldur the Beautiful.
Okay.
We love Baldur.
I already do.
Baldur is the god of light and beauty, and he was the favorite of heaven, the beloved son. His story is a tragedy.
Oh no.
Loki do.
And the death of Baldur is one of the greatest stories of Norse mythology, so obviously I'll tell that later. Baldur does have two younger brothers by Odin and Frigg, whose names are Hod, who is blind, and Vidar, who is mute, sorry, I should have said that. These two stories are also some of the most tragic in all of Norse mythology, and that's saying a lot, because Norse mythology is extremely tragic. But we do love Baldur. Let's see. Another son of Odin is Tyr, the one-handed god of war and justice. You'll note that both Tyr and Odin are gods of war and judgment. Tyr, so Odin is the god of, like, battle and war. You would dedicate a battle to Odin, a war, the slaughter, all of that. Tyr is a god of honor in war. So you might not invoke Tyr before a big battle, but you might invoke him before a duel, something like that.
A little bit.
He's also the god of peace treaties, if it helps.
Oh, a little bit of a Mars Minerva kind of dynamic.
Yeah, a little bit. Not as much, mostly because Odin is so much, like, more powerful than Tyr.
Ah, okay.
But anyway, we love Tyr. He's great. And I will tell you the story of how he lost his hand.
Oh, good.
It's very sad. Just, it's very sad. I should just, every one of
these assume it's sad.
Just assume sad. A couple of them are funny. Most of them are sad. Most of the other important gods are Vanir. So all the ones I've shared so far are of the Aesir, that is the sky gods. Most of the rest of them are the Vanir. These are the earth gods. So first and foremost are the siblings. Whether or not they are twins is a great question. Freya and Freyr. These are gods of fertility, female and male, respectively, and have to do with growing crops and growing children and falling in love and all of that. Freya seems to be the closest thing to a leader the Vanir have. And because of this, she's very often conflated with Frigg. They have a lot of common, maybe it's just because people aren't used to having stories with two different queens. they're both goddesses of magic. Freya much more so. Freya is not only a goddess of fertility, but magic and death and battle. Everyone's in love with Freya. Freya's amazing, and she has a chariot pulled by cats.
Yay!
So, like, does it get better than that? No! No, it doesn't! We love Freya. She's great. And her brother Freyr is absolutely love-struck. If you're looking for, like, the romantic with a capital R in Norse mythology, it's her brother Freyr. yeah. And I was going to make a joke, but this is a family-friendly podcast, so I can't tell you too much about Freyr. Just know that you know which one's Freyr because of his autonomy in statue form.
Oh, do you mean anatomy? Hey, do you mean anatomy?
Because of his anatomy in statue form.
An autonomous statue would actually
Freyr
be pretty cool.
He has anatomy in his statue form because he's Freyr.
So
anyway.
Basically, anything we know about statues to Hermes, we should transfer over to our knowledge of Freyr.
Yeah. No. So the Greeks had some reservations about size in this category. The Norse did not.
Yeah. I see.
Yeah. There's so many jokes right now. We got Thor's hammer, we got Freyr, I need to stop. Okay. Let's go back to the Vanir, because there's one I haven't mentioned, and I know you know who he is. Heimdall is of the Vanir as well. After the war, Heimdall came to Asgard and was made the watchman of the gods and the protector of the bridge, Bifrost, or Bifrost. He doesn't really seem to be the god of anything, besides, like, I don't know, good eyesight, I guess. But he has a very important job. Yeah, I mean, Odin is obsessed with Ragnarok, and Heimdall is, like, his go-to guy. So, we do love Heimdall. He's in a lot of stories as kind of like, Heimdall is also there. but he is part of the gods' council. When the gods get together and huddle up and discuss plans, Heimdall is there. And he's generally a wise god who listens before he speaks, unlike some people we could mention. That kind of thing.
Did you say that he was one of the captives who got sent over after the war?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, he is.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
A lot of them are. Actually, pretty much everyone I mentioned in the Vanir is.
Oh.
Yeah. We don't really know much about the Vanir who weren't sent over, frankly. There's a couple others who were sent over that I'll tell later. Mimir and Kvasir are both wise counselors. Very, very wise, very knowledgeable. Kvasir is said to have been able to answer any question, that kind of thing. If I have time, I'll tell their stories later. But yeah, Mimir and Kvasir are just knowledgeable counselors.
Hmm.
Anyway, who are we leaving out?
Loki.
Loki! Everybody's favorite. Loki is, we don't know.
Okay.
Loki is probably the son of a goddess called Laufey, as well as a Jotun's father. And yes, Marvel did take the female name Laufey and make Laufey into a male Jotun.
But
why? We don't know. Anyway, we don't know, like, is he Aesir? Dunno. Is he Vanir? Probably not. Why does he get to hang out with the Aesir? Why is he invited to all the councils? We don't know. What we do know is that a long time ago, possibly before the war, I don't know, Loki and Odin made oaths to one another to call each other blood brothers and never kill one another. So Loki may have done something for Odin. All we know is that they've entered a pact together. We don't know why, or really even how. This oath is tested a lot of times, because Loki is the word. but yes, if you can take away anything from this, Loki is not Thor's brother.
Got it.
He's actually more like Thor's uncle, because he is a blood brother of Odin, not an adopted son. Loki is not Thor's brother. And actually, really neither of them related to Frigg at all. Neither of them have a blood relation to Frigg.
Weird.
It's not a thing.
She's probably really happy about that.
Don't get me started on Hel. We'll talk about Hel some other time. Anyway. Loki is a trickster god. Sorry, what?
That's going to be really hard to fix in my brain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Loki is the blood brother of Odin. No relation to Thor.
Got it.
Yeah. But they were the two most popular, so comics. Anyway, Loki is a trickster god, which is like a type. You know, Hermes is a trickster god. Most mythologies have a trickster god in some way. Loki is also gender fluid and a master shapeshifter. So he often shapes into animals or other people, disguises himself. And again, like I said, gender fluid can really swap between this kind of male and female form very well. He also is one of the gods who practices Sæðir, which again is this female magic. And Loki and Odin seem to be the only two who get to do this without it really causing any question on their manhood. Mm. It's just like a thing that they get to do because they're special.
Interesting.
Anyway, Loki gives advice to the gods, and his advice gets them into trouble just about as much as it gets them out of trouble, so they tolerate him. It is because of Loki that the gods have many, many, many good things, but it is also because of Loki that they have a lot of tragedy.
Sir, this is my emotional support, half-giant.
Well, the gods will eventually get their own. Loki has several notable children, all six of whom we will discuss.
Okay.
And only two of which are by his wife, Sigyn. So yes, he has six kids, by three different people, one of whom is male. Well, we'll talk about that later. Okay, so I've set the stage, I've introduced the players. I don't think I really have enough time to tell a lot of stories. In later episodes, I will tell you about how the gods got their weapons, about how Odin lost his eye, about how poetry came into the world, about that one time Thor had to cross-dress at his own wedding, and about all of the children of Loki and Ragnarok. There are a lot of stories here, and if there's any ones you specifically want to know, let me know. I'll take a note that I should add Idun's story to this, just so we get some more ladies up in here.
Yay.
Question?
That's so interesting.
Can we hear about the, oh wow, my mind is going blank. The guardian angels of Valhalla.
Ooh,
the Valkyries?
Yes, Valkyries.
Can we hear about Valkyries?
Okay, yeah, I didn't prepare anything for this, but Valkyries, basically work for Odin. Okay, so, when you die, right, there's three, actually, different places that you can go, but generally speaking, the Valkyries are the way you get to two of them. So if you die on the battlefield, the Valkyries will come, and they're called the Choosers of the Slain, and they choose or pick the people who died well in battle and stuff from a battlefield, and then take them up into, I say heaven, that sounds very Christian, but the Asgard, into the Hall of Odin, in which they are judged. And if they are judged worthy, they receive a seat in Odin's hall, which is called Valhalla. The people of Valhalla are called the Erinhjar. There we go.
Yay.
I probably pronounced that wrong. So they're called the Erinhjar. They are the warriors of Odin. Odin, if you didn't know, surprise, 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 is collecting an army to fight with him and Ragnarok.
What?
Because poor little Odin is so paranoid. He's collecting an army to fight with him in Ragnarok. Those in Valhalla feast all day with food and mead that never ends. And every day they go out onto the field of battle, beat each other up,
fall down dead, raise back up as friends, and go back into the hall and feast.
So oh my gosh, you're telling me that their eternal reward is just a training program for the end of the world?
That's awful. But there is That's a lot infuriating. Of... I was gonna say another thing, but this is a family-friendly podcast. There is a lot of feasting and...
socializing.
Sleeping.
Would you use the word carousing?
Well, I was gonna make some jokes with, like, a running of Fs, but we're not gonna do that. They have these rewards, and then they have a great time beating each other up, and then being friends about it. So, yes, that's Valhalla. How you get to Valhalla, again, is you die in battle, the Valkyries bring you to Odin, Odin judges you worthy. If Odin does not judge you worthy, one of the places you can go is a place that's really often forgot about in Greek myth, that I'm a big fan of, called Folkvangr, which is literally the Valley of the People. It is in Vanaheim, and it is the realm of Freya. And we don't know much about it, but I think it sounds great. I mean, so one of the big tensions you'll see in more modern tellings about Norse mythology is this idea that even though the sky gods won the war, and so we worship them because they're powerful, the earth gods are better for humanity. And maybe the Aesir are not good guys, especially for humanity. So the fact that you have these two afterlives, and one is the one that, like, oh yeah, everyone wants to go to Valhalla, it's awesome, because the Aesir are there, and Odin. Like, in reality, I would much rather go to Folkvangr and hang out with Freya, so,
yeah,
like...
Yeah, same.
The army of Folkvangr will fight in Ragnarok, because everyone will, but they're not, like, trained to be warriors. They are just kind of also here waiting for the end of the world.
Huh.
Yeah. That's not mentioned in a lot of Greek myths, but it is part of the story and a part I'm a big fan of. The other third afterlife is hell. We'll talk about hell, but basically, if you die in any other way, or like a coward, or like of sickness or something, like a baby, you go to hell, and you suffer forever.
That's horrible.
And there's kind of a fourth-ish fate. If for whatever reason your soul cannot make it to where it's supposed to go, maybe the Valkyrie missed you or something, you can haunt the world as either a ghost or a Draugr, which is something kind of like a zombie.
Gross.
I take it back.
But these are very uncommon. These are very uncommon, frankly. So as far as who the Valkyrie are, okay, so sorry, you asked about Valkyrie, not about the afterlife. So the Valkyrie are depicted in several ways. They are warrior women. They have flying horses that aren't necessarily Pegasi, by the way. They just walk on the air. they are these kind of guardians, but they're also called the swan women. So there's actually a tradition that Valkyries can shapeshift into swans. And that sometimes they come to Earth, marry men, have their lives, but then are kind of called back away to the Valkyrial duties, in which they transform back into swans and leave.
You know,
so
swans
is this
are
to
mean
justify
enough?
The fact? Yeah, I was gonna say, is this to justify the fact that swans can beat the ever-loving snot out of you?
I don't know. Maybe. Swans are both big and mean and beautiful and usually depicted as feminine. So maybe. But yes, they're called the swan women as well as the choosers of the slain.
I want to be a swan woman.
And there are stories of Valkyries who live what seem to be pretty human lives. Sometimes it seems like Valkyries are just women who sometimes get called out to do work for Odin. And sometimes it feels more like they are women who have kind of chosen this profession in Odin's court, but eventually are gonna retire. There are different stories of Valkyries, but sometimes they're very human. There are people who have married Valkyries. There's one very, very famous Valkyrie called Brunhild.
Hey guys, do you want
to
join
my new... So what would you like to know about the Valkyries?
Oh, sorry. I just wanted to know if you guys wanted to join my new freelance work share app called Swan Woman.
Yes, I would. Very much so. And like I said, there are different versions of the myth, so it may be that some of our readers are actively being like, no! right now. Sorry, I just, like, blew out my mic. And that's fine. There are lots of different myths, and these are just some of the ones that I know. Why I love mythology so much, especially Norse mythology, is that I strongly believe that the beauty of mythology is in its telling. There are a lot of ways to get mythology right and a lot of ways to get it wrong, and it doesn't matter nearly so much what the case was as how and why we tell it. You've listened to a podcast about this now. I'm not going to say you're an expert, but I am going to say that you should go and tell stories. So if you want to share these stories with someone else, you don't have to just share the podcast. You can go tell the stories yourself. Tell how fire and ice came together to form a nothing, and that all the world was created from the sacrifice of the first being.
And heaven is guarded by really angry swans.
And heaven is guarded by really angry swans and a big rainbow bridge.
And a guy named Heimdall.
Yeah. Anyway, like I said, the closest you get, there are, okay, so this is a fun part of Greek culture. I don't know if this could be the podcast or not. Anyway, there's a thing called flighting. Flighting is like fighting, but instead of physical, it's all with words. The Vikings invented rap battles.
Yes!
Yes!
It was all about exchanging insults to rhyme and insulting each other worse than the other person insulted you. The gods participate in this. At one point, someone has a rap battle with Odin. It doesn't go well. But anyway, in flighting, a lot of the things that gets brought up is someone's manliness, and sometimes the insults we hear are homophobic.
Like, hey, you're gay.
Yeah. Okay. And some of them are also misogynistic in that they're like, I hear that you do female magic. What a girl.
Wow.
So we do have a lot of that in there.
It's just like rap battles in the mid-aughts.
Just like, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's a lot of different things about gender where people can be like, oh, women were treated well, better than the Greeks and stuff. But it's not. It's not perfect. It's not all there, and there's a reason why only men are in most of these stories, and it's because they're the ones people chose to write about. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm not an expert, but those are some of the stories that I've learned.
Thank you so much for sharing. Yeah. Well, if you would like to loudly critique our portrayal of Valkyries, or you have a cursed science fact to share, you can always email us at theliberalarts@gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our theme song, and to Natalie Bree for our editing. Thank you, Nat.
We love you.
We love you.
We love you. Thank you. You can find links to terrifying snail documentaries in the show notes, I guess, as well as links to our other social media.
You know, just poisonous snails in our social media.
I don't participate in Instagram. I just watch snails chase down and eat starfish.
Okay. There's something for everyone in our show notes.
Go buy Neil Gaiman's book, because it's good.
We'll put a link to that, too.
You are Neil Gaiman, just know that you're the best.
We're gonna tag him in our Instagram.
Tag Neil Gaiman in our Twitter.
Ooh, okay.
Actually, he responded to one of my tweets once. Actually, okay, this was funny. So let me just share this story. So I bought his audiobook because I had an Audible credit, and I liked it so much that I bought the physical book. And then they made the BBC Radio Play, and it was hosted online for free a couple months, but then it got taken down. And I waited and waited and waited and waited for the Radio Play to be put up on Audible, but it wasn't. So eventually I tweeted at Neil Gaiman and was like, where can I buy this? And he was like, I think in the UK there's a CD version. And I was like, oh. So I had to track down a seller who would ship me a CD of this radio play. It got to my house, and my old computer would not read the CD, so I had to get an external CD drive, and then it downloaded in a file format that I couldn't play, so I had to get another media player to play it, and y'all, the struggle I have gone through for this audiobook. But eventually I did get it in a format where I could listen to it on my, in my car on my drive across the country when I moved to grad school. So, you know what, Neil Gaiman, I have struggled for you.
That is a wonderful story. And
but it was worth it, frankly. I love it. I love it.
This is my favorite Etta.
Neil Gaiman has my favorite Etta.
Thank you for that. Are you going to say the thing or aren't you?
Oh, shoot. That's my job. I haven't done a colloquium in a while. Okay. So thank you for listening, and until next time, learn something worth knowing.
Yay. I feel like reciting epic verse now.
Go ahead.
No, I feel like it's a thing that should be done.
You don't know
I don't actually no.
I don't know any
verse off the top of my head. No, unless
rage.
You count like
Sing
the Jabberwock.
Sing the rage of Achilles, Peleus' son, who cost the Greeks countless losses.
Oh my gosh.
And excuse me, the Greeks and Chalcy will pay.